John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, January 19th, 2012. 76 acres of land is to be confiscated just east of Bethlehem, and another illegal settlement outpost is dismantled in the West Bank, this time with injuries. These stories and more coming up, so stay tuned. During the eviction of an unauthorised settlement outpost Thursday morning, Israeli troops arrested three Israeli settlers who were protesting the eviction. During the clashes that resulted, six settlers and three Israeli police officers were slightly injured. The police were injured when they climbed onto the roof of a building to remove a settler who had barricaded himself there, and the roof subsequently collapsed. Settlers claimed the police used violence against them, including the use of tear gas canisters and batons, with the police claiming that the settlers held rocks at them and burned tyres. Hours before the razing of the outpost, the Israeli security forces also took down a structure in the Oz Zion outpost near Route 60. The police used stun grenades against the settlers after the protesters threw stones at them. Yizor Bracha is an outpost made up of six structures, next to the Mizpeh Jericho settlement in the eastern West Bank near the Palestinian city of Jericho. In other news, the Arab 48 news website has reported that three Arab students studying at the Engineering Academy in Jerusalem have received police warrants exiling them from the city for 7 days after they called for a boycott of a speech by Israeli President Shimon Peres. Two of three students have been named as Khalil Gara from JIT and Rafat Shaban from Majd al-Qurum. Their lawyer has stated that all student groups have the right to express their opinions by calling for the boycott of any program or official. In Gaza, the Israeli army fired several shells at farmlands in Beit Hanun, in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, with eyewitnesses stating that Israeli tanks fired at farmland near the agricultural college. No injuries were reported. Back in the West Bank, Palestinian families were shocked by the decision to confiscate 76 acres of land to the benefit of the Jerusalem municipality. The land lies behind the annexation wall in Al-Khaz village, in the eastern part of the West Bank city of Bethlehem. The Israeli court claimed that the decision was made because these lands are under the custody of the Absentee Properties Guard, but the head of the village council, Khadir Hamdan, stated that the council, in coordination with the settlement affairs ministry, has assigned the case to the ministry's lawyer to solve the problem and appeal the illegal decision. That's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, January 19th daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope that you will join us again tomorrow. This has been brought to you by Hussam Qassis and me, William Gibson.
As the U.S. and European Union ratcheted up economic sanctions against Iran for what the West believes is the Islamic Republic's covert effort to build nuclear weapons, the assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist has escalated an already tense situation. 32-year-old Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan, a university professor who served as deputy director for commercial affairs at Iran's Natanz uranium enrichment facility, and his driver were killed January 11th in Tehran when a bomb attached to his car exploded. Witnesses said that a motorcyclist placed a magnetic bomb under the car, an explosive similar to those that have killed other Iranian scientists. This was the fifth time in 2 years that scientists working in Iran's nuclear research program have been the target of assassination. Although Secretary of State Hillary Clinton categorically denied U.S. involvement in the murder of Mr. Roshan, the Iranian government has placed blame on both Israel and the United States for recent assassinations. Iranian officials have vowed that the nation's nuclear program that they maintain is for civilian energy production only will move forward despite the violence. Concerned that Israel may be planning airstrikes against Iran's nuclear facilities, published reports say that President Obama and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta have warned Israel against taking unilateral military action and instead allow more time for sanctions to pressure Iran. The two nations have also postponed joint missile defense exercises for the spring in order to avoid further escalating tensions with Iran. Your reporter spoke with Mohammad Sahimi, professor of chemical engineering and materials science at the University of Southern California. Sahimi, an Iranian native, expresses concern about the recent assassinations of Iranian scientists and rising tensions with the West that could lead to war.
We have had a covert war that has been going on against Iran since 2001. Those listeners of your program that are interested can go to PBS Frontline Tehran Bureau website and see my latest posting there where I chronicle the decade-old covert war against Iran since 2001, when in July 2001, a leading figure in Iran's conventional missile program was found dead in his office with a bullet in his head. Then in January 2007, a prominent Iranian nuclear scientist was killed. Then we had two other prominent nuclear scientists. One was assassinated in summer of 2010, and another one barely escaped the assassination, who is now the president of Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Then we had another nuclear scientist assassinated just last summer, and then the latest one was this past week, Mustafa Roshan, who was also was in a senior position at Natanz uranium enrichment facility in central Iran, where the bulk of Iran enrichment activity is taking place. That has created a lot of tension in Iran and also in the West. I believe it is counterproductive because it has basically cornered the Iranian government into a position that if these assassinations and other aspects of covert war that continue, then it may compel the Iranian government to take some sort of retaliatory actions against U.S. forces in that region and Israel, which can quickly spread and become a full-fledged war, which, in my opinion, will cause the world economy to collapse, because the first thing that it will do would be to dramatically increase the oil price in the international market. Iran has already threatened that it will close the Strait of Hormuz, which connects the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman, through which 20% of all the oil consumed in the world passes every day. Of course, if Iran closes the strait, the U.S. Fifth Fleet, which is in Persian Gulf, it is headquarters in Bahrain, will surely intervene to reopen the strait. And of course, Iranians, if they are really intended to keep the strait closed, will react, and that would lead to a major war between United States and Iran. And this is a really a dangerous situation.
Professor Sahimi, it has been alleged that these assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists may have been specifically designed to provoke Iran to take military action in some way, shape, or form, which in turn could serve as a pretext for an attack on Iranian nuclear research facilities by either Israel or the United States. Do you think there is such a strategy going on here that has led to the orchestrated assassinations of these Iranian scientists?
I think this is the most plausible scenario behind the covert war, and including the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. It seems that at least one goal of this assassination is to provoke Iranians into taking some sort of retaliatory actions against U.S. And or Israel, most likely Israel, which would lead to a counterattack, and then it will compel the United States to enter the war in defense of Israel. There are other, of course, goals that are presumably pursued by such a covert war and a program of assassination, including creating a sense of insecurity among the Iranians, worsening the economic situation due to political instability, and frightening Iranian scientists from joining Iran's nuclear program, most of which I think are baseless. In fact, there has already been a backlash in Iran against such assassinations, because when it comes to protecting Iran's national assets and resources, including its scientists, Iranians, regardless of where they stand in the political spectrum, are united. And in fact, that by itself is also dangerous, in the sense that if Iranians are united or mostly united, then that may provide a window for the Iranian government, which is repressive, which has had bad economic policies that has led to a terrible economic situation, in addition to the sanctions that have been imposed on Iranians, and also distract the people from their real goal, which is democratizing Iran and moving it in a democratic movement. So this covert war and this program of assassination have actually been totally counterproductive, because if the goal of the covert program and assassination is to slow down Iran's nuclear program, it's not going to achieve the goal, because about 30,000 people work in Iran's nuclear program, and therefore assassinating a few, even if they are top scientists, is not going to do much to slow down the program. The only way that we can reach some sort of accommodation with the Tehran regime and lower the tension and the possibility of war is to pursue diplomacy, such that both nations can see the benefit of it, and therefore they can come to the negotiation table and reach some sort of compromise.
That was Mohammad Sahimi, professor of chemical engineering and materials science at the University of Southern California and lead political columnist with the PBS Frontline Tehran Bureau website. Find links to Professor Sahimi's columns and other related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan, Monday. Three American mercenaries working for the Pentagon were killed when their helicopter crashed in southern Afghanistan. The contractor's company, AAR Airlift, reported this incident, adding that there were no other passengers in the helicopter and the cause of the crash was not yet known. Jalalabad, Afghanistan, Tuesday. A suicide car bomber attacked a U.S. military base, killing at least one person and wounding two others. Gunar Province, Afghanistan, today. Hundreds of protesters demanded an end to deadly U.S. night raids. The protests may have been sparked by a Monday night air raid that killed five civilians, including a woman and a child. North Waziristan, Pakistan, Tuesday. Local tribesmen using rifles and heavy machine guns opened fire on U.S. drones flying over their land at low altitude. This time, all the drones were able to avoid being shot down. Next time might be different, as in Iran. Ramadi, Iraq, Sunday. Insurgent fighters dressed as police but wearing bomb vests instead of body armor raided a police compound where a senior insurgent leader was imprisoned. At least three suicide bombers detonated explosives, at least five police officers were killed, and at least four other people were killed. car bombs were used in addition to the bomb vests. At least 14 people were wounded as well as those who were killed. The attacks began with a car bomb in a downtown parking lot that wounded 3 people, presumably as a diversion. Next, another bomb killed 3 police officers on patrol. 5 minutes after that, another car bomb detonated outside the water treatment plant. Minutes later, the insurgents in police uniforms tried to storm the police headquarters where a high-ranking Al-Qaeda prisoner was being held. Police returned fire and were able to prevent their position from being overrun. The attackers then holed up in a nearby building under construction. As security forces tried to storm that building, a firefight erupted, ending only when the remaining insurgents detonated their bomb vests. Iraq, Saturday. Another in the ongoing wave of brutal sectarian attacks killed 50 Shiite pilgrims. Aqaba, Iraq, today. A total of 12 bombs went off in Aqaba today. 3 of these were Shiite-owned grocery stores being blown up, presumably by Sunni sectarian extremists. Mr. Barack Obama, Iraq is no role model for Afghanistan, and neither are those so-called Marines who urinated on the bodies of the dead. Now's the time to pull the plug. Bring all the troops home today.
On January 13th, the officer in charge of an evidentiary hearing investigating allegations that Army Private First Class Bradley Manning leaked classified government documents to WikiLeaks determined that the 24-year-old Manning should be court-martialed on all 22 charges. Private Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables, more than 90,000 intelligence reports, and a video of a U.S. helicopter attack in Baghdad, later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. Among the most serious charges are aiding the enemy, a capital offense, although government prosecutors have said they will not pursue the death penalty. But if convicted on all counts, Bradley Manning could spend the rest of his life in prison. His trial is expected to begin in the next few months. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Kevin Gostola, a civil liberties blogger with Fire Dog Lake, a website that has championed Manning's cause from the beginning. Fire Dog Lake and the Bradley Manning Support Network have exposed the inhumane treatment they say Manning was subjected to at the Quantico Naval Brig that included solitary confinement and being stripped naked for extended periods of time. Here, Gostola describes the decision to move to a court-martial and the strategy of both the defense team and the government in pursuing the case.
Well, the latest news is that all of the charges that were being, I guess you would say, deliberated on, the investigative officer had to make a decision after the pretrial hearing whether or not those would be charges that went into a court-martial. He decided that all of them, and there's 23 different charges, including an aiding the enemy charge, which is a capital offense that carries the possibility of the death penalty, and those charges are all going to carry into the court-martial.
How does Bradley Manning seem? Do you know anything about his state of mind?
What I had been telling people who asked about what I thought and how he looked, he's been detained, held in detention for more than 550 days. And I said, you know, for being in detention that long, he actually looked pretty normal. It's very hard to detect that he has any sort of issues from being confined. I'm not saying that he has no problems. I'd say that he's very happy and pleased. And from his aunt, we have a bit of a note that came out around Christmas time, that he was very pleased with all the support that he received during the hearing, and he wanted all of his supporters to know that, you know, he was doing well and was getting along fine.
Kevin Gostola, please just remind our listeners about the defense Manning's lawyer plans to present.
I think that their case is going to be built around, one, the mental state of Bradley while he was there. He believes that he's actually a different gender, so a woman, and has had gender identity issues, and they're going to push that angle. And they also are going to push the angle of how the place where he worked, the facility that he was doing his intelligence analyst work, they're going to push how the information security in that area was lax and how people were able to get away with downloading stuff to their computers and taking information in and out of the facility without really having too many superiors asking questions about what was being done, playing games, movies, listening to music on the drives. It's just bad information security. And then the final thing I would say is they are going to push that there hasn't been any risks to national security. But the one obstacle that he's had, and you can see that from his requests for depositions in the aftermath of the Article 32 hearing or the pretrial hearing, is he wants the original classification authorities to have to testify under oath or on the record about the harm. They've submitted unsworn statements. They assert that there's been harm, but they haven't been put under oath, and so those are just what they say. And he really wants to put these people under oath and force them to say that there's been a risk, because it's not clear what that risk is.
But they probably wouldn't specify the harms because they'd say that would compromise national security, like they have in other cases, no?
Well, so they would do this under classified information. So all these depositions that the lawyer David Coombs wants to do, and this is his request, and on the same day that this came out, that the 23 charges would proceed to the court-martial, David Coombs made a request for on-the-record depositions, and he wanted to get these all from individuals, and they would be classified. Testimony would be offered. So that would mean that the public would never really know what sort of information was shared with the defense. But at least he would get the evidence he needed to make his case for Bradley Manning.
Say a little more about the aiding the enemy charge, which potentially carries the death penalty, even though government lawyers have said they won't seek it.
So the aiding the enemy charge, it's just terrible that the government is going this far, and it is overreaching. And the biggest issue is that they're claiming that Bradley Manning knew that he was going to give the information to Al-Qaeda indirectly through WikiLeaks. This is what was said, actually, during the hearing. And if you think about this argument, it's a really bad one for people who like to cover national security issues, because in a sense, what they're saying is, if you put something out there that can be available to terrorists, then you could be considered somebody who deserves to be criminalized. Now, depending on your effect. So Bradley Manning has been very effective in what he has done, and it seems like aiding the enemy charge is all about making an example out of Manning. His lawyer also says it's part of trying to flip him and get him to testify against Julian Assange and other people in WikiLeaks. So this aiding the enemy charge is entirely all about intimidation, and so far there's no justification to show that he was working or operating for terrorists.
That was Kevin Gostola, a civil liberties blogger who writes for the FireDogLake.com website. Learn more about the charges against Bradley Manning by visiting our website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to support groups, news articles, analysis, and commentary about the case.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. The 17th of January, three whale warriors from Sea Shepherd were wounded when the whalers threw iron grappling hooks at them from the high decks of the Yushin Maru No. 2. The Yushin is tailing the Sea Shepherd ship Steve Irwin as it races back to the whalers' fleet, and the Steve Irwin deployed small boat teams to slow them down. Two Steve Irwin crew members were struck in the shoulder with iron grappling hooks, and one crew member was struck twice in the face with a long bamboo pole. American crew member Brian Race, 25 years old from New York, was jabbed twice in the face with a bamboo pole, receiving lacerations above his right eye and on his nose. Russell Berg of South Africa, 35 years old, a cameraman for Animal Planet, was struck in the right arm and shoulder with an iron grappling hook thrown from the harpoon ship, resulting in deep bruising. Photographer Guillaume Collet of France, 27 years old, was also struck in the right arm and shoulder by an iron grappling hook, resulting in deep bruising. None of the poachers aboard the Japanese whaling ship were hurt. The 17th of January, Congress returned from their winter break into the teeth of the Occupy Congress protests. Up to 2,000 people gathered in front of the U.S. Capitol for an all-day rally. Events began with people visiting members of Congress to lobby against bank bailouts and service cuts for taxing the rich and against corporate campaign cash. In the afternoon, more muscular tactics were adopted. Shortly before 4 p.m., Occupy Congress marched on the Rayburn House Office Building. They were repulsed from entering as a group, but enough people got inside for a 17-person mic check the Rayburn's inside courtyard. Meanwhile, Independence Avenue was blocked until cops managed to push everybody onto the sidewalks. At that point, the Rayburn steps became totally blocked with protesters due simply to their numbers. It was not a good day to be a House Republican with an office at the Rayburn House Office Building. One detachment broke away from the Rayburn to go to the Longworth House Office Building, where about half entered the building and lined up at the bag search checkpoint. One person in a costume was refused entry and gave this interview. Did anybody manage to get past the checkpoints?
Yeah, everybody. So long as it just takes time. I'm the King of America. I just sent my royal emissary in to hand off our grievances to the Speaker of the House.
Did you get in?
I'm wearing a mask. They won't let me in.
Did they get someone else?
They got in just fine. They're like, sure.
Of course, the actual King of America would wear a suit and tie and would be a lobbyist working for a corporation like TransCanada, the tar sands oil pipeline company that will now take advantage of Citizens United in an attempt to overturn the president's rejection of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline with a flaming gusher of campaign cash in Congress.
I'm a black dog man.
About 4:30 p.m., protesters left the House office buildings and marched through the streets as far as 7th Street before returning to base camp in front of the U.S. Capitol. At about 6:30 p.m., Occupy Congress marched again, this time taking over and occupying the steps of the Supreme Court building. I've never seen this done before except for civil disobediences. This time, the whole protest surged up the steps like a human tsunami while the cops got out of the way, just like they would for a tsunami of wave and water. Atop the steps, there was an incredibly loud chant of, "Money is not free speech," condemning the notorious Supreme Court Citizens United case that legalized unlimited campaign cash in American politics. I guess this tells you what Occupy thinks of the Supreme Court's Citizens United case that legalized unlimited corporate campaign cash in American politics. Steps are entirely taken. The ornamental door of the Supreme Court is entirely blocked. You can get out of the plaza, but that's it. Black flags at the top. Not only is money not free speech, it's not even free! After holding the Supreme Court steps for a while, Occupy Congress returned to the streets for a march to the White House, the third branch of government to face them that night. When it got there, everyone swarmed the White House fence, and again the cops stood out of the way of the human flood. Then there was an allegation that a smoke bomb was thrown over the fence, but I saw no smoke. The White House security lights came on, the north entrance of the White House was closed, and Obama may have had to delay his return from dinner at an off-site location. The protests continued. Police did make a show of displaying some riot gear, but at the end they decided to wait it out. This was not a crowd that tolerated police harassment. One attempted arrest during the day at the Capitol had to be abandoned when 300 protesters countercharged the police.
Here's what some of the speakers along the White House fence had to say. While police haven't stolen Occupy tents in D.C., in a lot of cities they have, and those night terror raids aimed at getting rid of Occupy are not succeeding.
Corporations will never pay!
Corporations will never pay!
Our freedom!
Our freedom!
Freedom
gets served!
Some of them were saying, Obama, come out, we've got some stuff to talk about. Don't tell me protest doesn't work. The very next day, President Obama said no to the Keystone XL pipeline, the issue that led to 1,200 arrests in front of the White House back in August and September. On the 18th of January, President Obama said no to the Keystone XL tar sands oil pipeline. This means TransCanada has to start over from the beginning with a new proposal and a new route. It won't be able to stack the State Department review with paid flunkies like last time around. This might even mean the Keystone XL oil pipeline is all the way dead. Climate scientists have called the Keystone XL the fuse to the largest carbon bomb on Earth. Tar sands oil is even worse than coal on global warming gases. To get just one barrel of oil from the tar sands requires the energy equivalent of up to four additional barrels to steam the oil out of the tar. On top of all else, the spit mines in Alberta and Canada are destroying Native American land and poisoning water Native American people depend on. Protest works. The defeat of the Keystone XL is a rare victory made possible by the over 1,200 people who were arrested in front of the White House between August 20th and September 3rd while Hurricane Irene bore down on Washington, D.C. This is victory on a brute force issue, meaning a strategic victory over a project that some amount of exploitation of people and destruction of the land will not take place without. Tar sands mining is currently limited by the amount of pipeline capacity. Republicans are already screaming about this. Without the Keystone XL, less oil will be available, but the reduction in greenhouse gases will be five times the reduction in the availability of cheap gasoline. Without the Keystone XL, people in the United States might build fewer new suburbs, make fewer trips to Disneyland, and buy more economical cars instead of highly profitable sport utility vehicles. This will in turn moderate the increase in gas prices, but it sure won't moderate demands from the bankers and corporate executives that the Keystone XL be brought back.
The indulgence of our lives has cast a shadow on our world.
On January 16th, as the nation honored the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the group United for a Fair Economy released a report titled State of the Dream 2012, The Emerging Majority. The report finds that in the year 2042, when people of color will collectively represent the majority of the U.S. population, the economic divide between racial groups will likely remain and may get considerably worse if current economic policies of the last three decades are unchanged. United for a Fair Economy's 9th annual assessment of Dr. King's dream of racial equality examines trends across a variety of indicators, including income, wealth, education, employment, health, and incarceration. If current trends continue, the report finds, black poverty will be nearly twice as high as white poverty, and the nation's Latinos will be living in poverty at more than 2.5 times that of whites. The report also presented data indicating that the estimated black family income in 2042 will be 61 cents for every dollar earned by white families, while Latinos will earn only 45 cents for every dollar made by white households. Your reporter spoke with Diedrich Muhammad, senior director of the NAACP's Economic Department and co-author of the State of the Dream 2012 report. He discusses the disturbing conclusions of the report and some of the recommendations made for changes in public policy that will be necessary to substantially reduce racial economic inequality.
Well, this year we decided to look at, people have talked about how increasingly the United States of America is no longer a majority white country. And that by 2042, in about 30 years, it's estimated that that we will actually reach this point where the majority of America is no longer white. So the majority of America will be minorities. And we wanted to see and highlight that if we continue the racial economic inequality that we have today, that is deeply impacting African Americans, Native Americans, and Latino Americans in particular, and we then have this percentage of the population growing over the next 30 years, how dire and challenging that'll be to the country as a whole, and how it will really greatly strengthen our racial and economic divides, making, I think, the economy of this country that, you know, historically, or at least since the 1950s, has been renowned for being a great middle-class society. I think we're going to see increasingly divided by class and race country, which I think is really counter to the narrative we hear. I think oftentimes we hear that we're past these racial problems. Up until recently, we haven't really focused on the growing economic inequality in this country, and this report hopes to highlight how race and economic inequality is putting this country in a projection that is very dangerous.
Diedrich, what are some of the trends that you found in terms of the racial divide when it comes to statistics we're seeing on income, wealth, education, employment, health, and incarceration?
Yeah, well, you're laying out all the main areas. We'll start off again with income. You know, a lot of the initial report we put out in the early 2000s, we just kind of helped highlight that between about 1968 to about 2002, something around there, that African Americans had 1968 were making about 54 cents on every dollar that white Americans were making, and by about 2002, they were only making 57 cents. And so it took that over 30-year period to bridge that racial inequality by 3 cents. And we're looking at a continuing trend of very slow bridging of income inequality between blacks and whites. And we're projecting that by 2042, African Americans will be making 61 cents on every dollar that white Americans were making. And something that kind of really caught my attention was that Latino Americans, who by then will be almost 25% of the population in 2042, will have a declining ratio of income to white Americans, and will only be having about 45 cents on every dollar that white Americans have. And if you put blacks and Latinos together in 2042, that's going to be about 40% of the population. So we can see how this can really be challenging again for the economy as a whole, if you have this kind of growing weakness in terms of income for significant parts of the population. You know, and I want to point out, too, that this report, I think, has been fairly conservative because in terms of wealth, you know, we've been looking at African Americans and Latinos having about 10% of the wealth of white Americans, but that really only looks at data pre-Great Recession. If you looked at post-Great Recession from about 2007 to 2010, which we didn't include in the report, but I think it's interesting research, you can see through 2007, 2009, you can see a great decline in wealth where African Americans and Latinos are only have about 5% of the wealth of white Americans. And so in many ways, over the last 10 years, the country has been, you know, going in the wrong direction with greater inequality. And so it's even possible that if the country keeps going in the direction it's gone in for the last 10 years, that things will be even worse in terms of racial economic inequality in 2042.
Well, Diedrich, before we close out, I just wanted to ask you if you could just mention a few of the policy alternatives that the country could follow that would squarely address rising income inequality in the country.
Well, you know, there's many different ways, and I would recommend that people look at the report. But some of the suggestions in the report is looking at a more fair tax system. In the past, the wealthy, the most rich sectors of the economy were taxed much more heavily, and then that money was used to invest in programs for working class, middle class people. A lot of people don't understand that this country hasn't always been a middle class country, that this country really became a middle class country in the 1940s, 1950s, when there was massive federal spending, which also had a massive federal deficit, which really allowed for the majority of whites to become homeowners for the first time, for a massive increase in college attendance and college graduation from things like the GI Bill. But all those things happened when we still had a segregated America, and racial minorities were not allowed to participate in those programs in the same way, were not allowed to benefit. And so it's of no wonder that most racial minorities still haven't attained that type of a strong middle-class lifestyle that white America had through investment. And so a lot of our policies is looking at ways of how we can better invest and create a new American middle class. And then we need to also more strongly regulate the wealthiest, the most elite, to make sure that they don't continue to crowd out resources for themselves at the expense of the majority of this country.
That was Diedrich Muhammad, Senior Director of the NAACP's Economic Department and co-author of the State of the Dream 2012 report. Visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org, where you can find links to download a copy of the report.